Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We've got a large audience here, so for those of you who are sitting on the floor, it'll be worth it. So Annabel Crabb makes a welcome return to the Institute. She was here after the 2004 election talking about a book essentially on Mark Latham, and here after the 2007 election with a panel of commentators. And tonight, on the occasion of the publication of the quarterly essay Stop at Nothing, The Life and Adventures of Malcolm Turnbull, which came out quite recently, I'll introduce her very briefly. She's well known to you all, I guess. Annabel Crabb is the Sydney Morning Herald's political sketch writer and appears regularly on the ABC TV Insiders program. She is the author of Losing It, the inside story of the Labor Party in opposition, which was published in 2005, and currently this profile on Malcolm Turnbull. But Annabel's topic for tonight is Creatures of the Liberal Party. Annabel Crabb, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you to all of you for coming, particularly those of you who are accommodated on the floor. I hope it won't be too tedious for you. Now, I think the Australian Liberal Party has had two genuinely seismic moments in the last 2 years. And oddly enough, I don't count the November 2007 election defeat as one of those, nor do I count the loss of John Howard's own seat of Bennelong. Nor do I count the election of Malcolm Turnbull to the leadership, nor the election of Brendan Nelson to the leadership. Now, the first two events, by the time they occurred, were almost a foregone conclusion, I think. They weren't a surprise for the Liberal Party, so much as a kind of a dull blow. And as for the second two, well, Malcolm Turnbull was always as inevitable post-Howard as death or taxes. And Brendan Nelson, I think, was merely the best chance for those in the Liberal Party who were seeking to avoid debt or taxes for as long as possible. No, both the events I'm thinking of involved Peter Costello, and specifically, in point of fact, both of them were the same event. Peter Costello declaring his intention to retire from politics. He made that announcement first on November the 25th, 2007, and then again on June the 15th this year. And it speaks volumes for the madness, tension and desperation within the Liberal Party that Mr. Costello was able to extract genuine shock value from the same announcement twice. Now, Peter Costello's avowal on that day after the 2007 election loss, I think, was more seismic than the demise of John Howard, because it was genuinely unexpected. And it compounded the loss of Howard mightily, because, well, it meant that Plan B wasn't a plan anymore, and what with Plan A already gone, that meant serious trouble. It was also devastating, I think, because it explained and demonstrated how chimeric the appearance of stability in politics can be. Was there ever anything more constant-seeming than the triumvirate of Howard, Costello and Downer, who for 11 years held the three most powerful portfolios the Australian government has to offer? For a decade, these men appeared to be the spine of the Liberal Party, and Costello's announcement in 2007, I think, demonstrated in a graphic and terrible way just how quickly a political party can become invertebrate. Now, change had been overdue for some time, and now that it was here, at the wrong time, it was a disaster instead of a salvation. Now, this is an interesting question to examine in hindsight. How much change was there over the course of the Howard government? Of course, people came and people went. The Peter Reiths, the Robert Hills, the Michael Wooldridges and Dick Alstons moved through portfolios and off, in some cases, into comforting sinecures. The Abbotts and the Hockeys and the Nelsons and the Bruffs waxed and waned, largely at the prime ministerial whim. And Howard himself changed form prodigiously over the course of that time. He went from a low-spending, small-government kind of guy to the kind of guy who, when offered in 2004 at the election campaign launch 11 big ticket spending items to choose between, went ahead and ordered the lot. Everything, including the vegetarian order, as Peter Costello was later to put it. But there were only three people who were in the same cabinet positions at the end of the 11 years of the Howard government as they had been at the beginning. Only three people who didn't move a muscle despite extensive chit-chat speculating the obverse. They were John Howard, Peter Costello and Alexander Downer. And when people say of Malcolm Turnbull, yes, but he's not a creature of the Liberal Party. These three men are the creatures to whom the luckless Turnbull is generally, even if subconsciously, being compared. These are the people who provide the authoritative face of the Liberal Party as we have known it over the last decade or so, the people who have defined the party. So we have John Howard, who joined the Liberal Party in his teens, was elected to Parliament at the age of 34, who spent the 1980s as well as half the 1990s in a poisonous internecine death roll with his own party. John Howard, who eventually emerged victorious, having been seriously given up for dead, with his convictions and his robust ideologies more or less intact. Then there's Alexander Downer with his immaculate liberal pedigree, who bequeathed himself to the party at an early stage and has never had another serious job outside politics, really. His gracious departure from the party's leadership in 1994 mercifully outshone over time his ignoble incumbency in the role and established the circumstances under which the divisive figure of John Howard could finally be accepted with, well, broad resignation, if not actual peace. And Peter Costello, who, after a brief flirtation with the right wing of the ALP at university, nevertheless chose the way of the light and accomplished some early rites of passage in the university political scene of the 1970s, including his memorable thumping by a campus anarchist. Now, all three of these creatures, incidentally, are from what we might call the dry or conservative wing of the Liberal Party. Howard and Costello fought on the same side in the great West Side Story ideological dance-off of the aforementioned 1980s and 1990s, when the wets and the dries traded atrocities, and the dries established the H.R. Nichols Society and the wets retaliated with the rather more sinisterly named Black Hand Group. During the mid to late period of the Howard government, as party moderates and wets coalesced to become a loose pro-Costello coalition, and Costello acolytes briefed on Costello's differences with Howard in Indigenous policy and the Republic, it became harder for a time to remember that Costello was, by natural inclination, as dry as a twig. But order was restored, of course, when Howard departed the scene after the 2007 election, and Costello became the most influential voice in the party room, albeit from the backbench, militating for a harder line on industrial relations and a conservative one on climate change. So on the face of it, with the three creatures, Howard, Costello and Downer, holding the same formation over that decade, dominating the three most senior portfolios, the Howard government and the Liberal Party seemed a beacon of stability. But a lot about the Liberal Party changed over that time, between 1996 and 2007, behind this Mount Rushmore facade of liberalism. When the coalition won power in 1996, 36 new Liberal, National and Country Liberal MPs won the privilege of heading to Canberra. Of that 36, 28 had won seats from the ALP. Rather surprised new MPs they were too, in some cases. Many of them had been pre-selected under the leadership of Alexander Downer, a difficult stage during which dire predictions were made about the Liberal Party remaining in opposition for decades. Having lost the unlosable election in 1993, the Liberal Party, early in the next term, was not widely fancied to take government in 1996. So the Liberal pre-selection market was hardly flooded with applications. And in fact, Warren Entsch, the former crocodile hunter, joined the Liberal Party on the same day on which he put in his application form for pre-selection for the Queensland seat of Leichhardt. Sharman Stone, in order to run as a Liberal in the Victorian seat of Murray, had to set up a Liberal Party branch just to nominate. Elizabeth Grace, a Queensland teacher and mother of adult children, was the only applicant for Liberal pre-selection in the seat of Lilly, legend in the Liberal Party, which I've been unable, unfortunately, to confirm, is that she had applied for the gig to satisfy the obligations for her New Start allowance, but she won the seat from Wayne Swan anyway, with a swing of 6.9%. And Paul Marek, a coal miner who won the Queensland seat of Capricornia for the Liberals, couldn't be found for days after the election. He had gone back to the mines without even checking the results, assuming that there was no way he'd be elected. When Mr. Marek was exhumed and informed that he had in fact achieved a 6.9% swing and was now the member for Capricornia, Marek was upset about the fact that his new job would involve a substantial pay cut. Now, commonly, the class of 1996 featured small business people with no background in politics who were angry with Paul Keating. It turned out that voters on the whole agreed. Warren Entsch won Leichhardt with a swing of 4.18%, and other, even longer shots came romping home. Who would have dreamed that the western suburb Sydney seat of Lindsay, Labor's by a margin of more than 10%, would fall to the Liberal Party? And yet Jackie Kelly nabbed it with a swing of nearly 12%. Now, this collection of new coalition MPs wasn't a trivial addition to the parliamentary community in 1996. They made up nearly a quarter of sitting MPs. The academic from the ANU, Paul A. Pickering, who wrote a fascinating paper called The Class of 96, a biographical analysis of new government members of the Australian House of Representatives, describes the cultural and demographic change that these new MPs brought to their party. Pickering compared the class of 1996 to the similarly sized influx of coalition MPs that flooded into Canberra after the rout of the Whitlam government in 1975. Now, the class of 1975 had no women, and its inductees had come to conservative politics through predictable channels. Of the 1975 cohort, all but a handful were old boys of one of Australia's exclusive private schools, for example. Not the same as a private school. Among the class of 1996, by contrast, the circumstances are exactly reversed. Only a handful went to private schools, and the vast majority were graduates of state and Catholic secondary schools. And a full 12 of the 96ers were women, the majority small business people motivated by business and family issues. So the 1996 election, it's now clear, I think, changed not only the fortunes of the Liberal Party, but also its face. As Jackie Kelly told the House of Representatives in her maiden speech, the people here with me today are from all walks of life, housewives, social workers, businesswomen, people from the military, married, single, childless, people with eight kids, I think there was only one of those, grown-up kids, grandkids and kids under five. Whatever the bell curve in society is, it's reflected here in John Howard's government. Howard himself told me in the course of my research for this essay that the class of 1996 was memorable for bringing a new strain to the Liberal Party. He said, I mean, they had some association with the Liberal Party, but they were almost a breed apart. Now, the new arrivals changed the culture of the party too, in a way which complemented Howard's own instincts and prejudices. The first budget's deep cuts to the university sector established a settled bitterness towards Howard in those parts, and he reciprocated by promoting vocational education and encouraging youngsters to undertake apprenticeships. Over time, it became a popular mantra within the Liberal Party that a university education was not all that it was cracked up to be. Minister rates trade as valuable as degree, read the headline in the Courier Mail news story of November the 25th, 2004. That article reported on some comments from the Employment Training Minister, the 1996er Gary Hargrave from Queensland, talking about the fact that skills shortages had enhanced the desirability of a trade qualification. People with trade skills have all the power in the economy these days, he told the paper. Unfortunately, the psychology of the day is that if you haven't got a degree, you must be a dud. But the shortages mean that a trade qualification is as good as a PhD and would probably earn you more. Now, George Brandis, an Oxford-educated barrister, rose in the party room not long after this article appeared and questioned Howard directly on it. He was all in support of trade qualifications, he said, but was it really now the government's position that a hairdressing certificate was as good as a PhD? Now, as he asked his question, I'm told by one present, Brandis was heckled by some of his colleagues who jeered that people with degrees weren't as smart as they thought they were. One present told me he was howled down, of course. It was frightening. They were a mob by that stage. You couldn't just get up and say things like that. It was like the French Revolution. And Howard himself on that day made it fairly clear where his sympathies lay. "Oh, George," he said, "at least you have more chance of making some money with a hairdressing certificate." What caused this cultural shift within the Liberal Party? I mean, the eye goes where it's drawn. Howard brought the class of 1996 into the Parliament and they cleaved to him. It must be about Howard, you'd think. But many of the 1996ers were, as discussed above, pre-selected under Downer. If we return to the maiden speeches of the inductees, a common theme emerges. And there's a common motivation that drove this disparate band to down tools, pencils, and in one case actual crocodiles, to join the Liberal Party and seek public office. It's vaguely possible, I think, that this cultural change within the Liberal Party of Australia could indirectly be Paul Keating's doing. Whatever caused it, this change within the Liberal Party had huge consequences for John Howard. He never missed an opportunity to trumpet the defection of the blue-collar wing of Australia from Labor to the Coalition, and the classmates of 1996 were an excellent demonstration of this point. These MPs owed their political careers to Howard, and their fortunes felt inextricably entwined with his. Many of them learned everything they knew about politics from their leader. Perhaps it's most useful to think of them as political ducklings. Hatching out into the world of politics, they bonded with the first parental figure that they saw. And as John Howard prevailed again and again through political crises, which occurred regularly every term, their respect for him only grew, and few of them entertained any thoughts of another leader. And the class of 1996 proved to be political stayers of some tenacity. At the 98 election, 11 of them fell, but three of those, Don Randall, Bob Baldwin and Russell Broadbent, clawed their way back in subsequent elections, and by 2007, 11 full years after their initial arrival in Canberra, a healthy 23 of the original 36 remained. And this is relevant and influential because of all of those MPs, discounting, of course, those in the National Party without a vote in the Liberal leadership, only a handful ever would have voted for Peter Costello in a party room spill. They would be Joe Hockey, Phil Baresi, Andrew Southcott, and possibly Sharman Stone. So in political terms, the class of 1996, apart from effecting quite considerable cultural change within the Liberal Party, also functioned as a very effective Praetorian guard for John Howard for more than 11 years. Quite a marvel. While they didn't ever account for more than 50% of the coalition party room, there were enough of them to offer substantial resistance to Peter Costello or to anyone else with pretensions to the throne. To be fair, Costello didn't try especially hard to woo them. He thought many of the 1996ers were fools, an opinion of which most of them were sharply aware. And whereas Howard duchessed these MPs, made regular and tender solicitations of their opinions and staged an annual dinner in their honour, Costello avoided them. Now, just as it became voguish within the Liberal Party to decry university education, it became an accepted orthodoxy that political professionals, people who had worked as staff members or officials within the party, made somehow for less desirable MPs than the ordinary people who had knocked around a bit. One MP told me, "It was a land where the non-politician was king, where the Bob Baldwins and the Jackie Kellys were regarded as the smart people because they could win seats, and the political hacks were the idiots because they didn't understand how ordinary people thought." Howard's version of events is necessarily more moderate. He told me, "I would never have denigrated the role of political professionals, but I didn't want Parliament to be full of people whose previous experience had been as political staffers. I had a very strong concern that we'd end up with politics on both sides being dominated by people whose whole careers had been in politics." Political astuteness is not measured by the length of time you've worked in politics. I think the best combination for the Liberal Party, and this is why I wanted to see Malcolm Turnbull come in, I wanted to see people whose life experiences had been a mix of politics from an early age, but who had spent a dozen or so years doing something else. Now, the optimum experience he describes here, consciously or unconsciously, is very precisely his own. Howard was involved in the Liberal Party from an early age, then practiced as a solicitor for exactly 12 years before entering politics. By and large, Howard got his wish, a party room richly supplied with real people who had a pleasing additional tendency to agree with everything he said. Of course, no such stability would have been possible without Howard's own deep policy convictions, which became the policy convictions of the party and thus the government. After all, as the Bible reminds readers at Corinthians, if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to the battle? But there's no doubt that the compliance of the starstruck party room was invaluable to the stability and durability of John Howard's government for a while. Now, the downsides of unhesitating adulation are never immediately apparent to its subject. That's the difficulty with sycophants. They are very handy, and the chances are that at some point in the cycle they were even right about your genius. But you can't just go on believing them forever. And for John Howard, I think you could fairly say that the class of 1996 was incredibly helpful, right up until the point at which it became incredibly unhelpful. And this tipping point came at about the time at which it would have been useful for John Howard and the Liberal Party to effect a sensible leadership transition. Now that Howard's gone, moreover, I think the party is paying for the lack of deeper thought and planning that might have carried it more easily through this period in opposition. Now, leadership is, to be fair, a terribly difficult thing. You really need to be bloody-minded enough and convinced enough of your own ideas to be able to survive the daily slings and arrows. Without bloody-mindedness and self-belief, how on earth could John Howard ever have survived the 1980s? How could he ever have survived Mr. 18%? Why on earth does this man bother? But the tricky thing is that at the same time as being incredibly thick-skinned, you have to be sensitive enough to catch the moment when the mood changes. I always think that leaving leadership at the right time, knowing when to abdicate, is sort of like telling your kids about the birds and the bees. Everyone thinks that when the time comes for them to do it, they'll be dignified and gracious and everything will go like clockwork. And of course, when it actually happens, it's an embarrassing disaster for all concerned. So, where does all this leave Malcolm Turnbull? Well, it leaves him in charge of an outfit which, in many ways, is still moulded around John Howard and is accustomed to Howard's ways and, you can sense it sometimes, still wakes up surprised some mornings to find that he's gone. Malcolm Turnbull is a very different person, a very different politician from John Howard, a very different Liberal too. Now, this obviously creates some difficulties in terms of just slipping into the tracksuit and taking up where Howard left off. But that's not always a bad thing. It's not all a bad thing. Mr. Turnbull's differences from John Howard can be useful in that they create a way for the party to distance itself from elements of the Howard legacy without delivering a direct insult to him. And that's very important, not just for the party at large, which still hugely reveres John Howard. This is the Liberal Party, remember, so it will probably be, you know, at least 10 years before they turn against him and start hissing at him in the street. But it's also important for the Australian electorate, which I think tossed out Mr. Howard while retaining an element of respect, even fondness for him. It wasn't baseball bats, which John Howard found waiting for him, in my opinion, in 2007. It was more the polite, slightly regretful, but nonetheless firm instruction that it was time, past time. The ALP, incidentally, knew this too. That's why they didn't run outright attack ads on John Howard. The most high rotation ad that I remember had an actress saying, "I'm sorry, Mr. Howard, nothing personal, but it's time to go." But Malcolm Turnbull has other differences from John Howard, of course, and I think the principal difference is that Malcolm Turnbull is memorable for his own personality, his own story, his charisma, his ambition, his outrageousness, and the extraordinary adventures over a life richly lived. John Howard, on the other hand, a man of relatively dull plumage personally, was fascinating because of the vigour of his beliefs and the tenacity and energy with which he pursued them. I'm not an ideological person, Malcolm Turnbull told Fran Kelly in that famous interview conducted one day before he went down in the leadership ballot to Brendan Nelson. And it's true that he has nowhere near the ideological drive of Howard. Malcolm Turnbull is by nature a classic libertarian, an advocate of hands-off government. This is a perfectly respectable liberal approach, historically speaking. It doesn't match with John Howard, who, by the time he handed in his badge, was a fairly hands-on sort of prime minister. Well, I'm not sure that it matches the zeitgeist at the moment either, as we glance around at a world occupied with getting itself through this financial crisis. We notice that Western governments are full of people with their hands-on levers. Intervention has never been so popular. The times, in other words, do not suit Malcolm Turnbull especially. And of additional concern for him is the suspicion with which certain party colleagues still view him. And there are a lot of reasons for this suspicion. One is that he hasn't been in politics for very long. The Liberal Party tends to like a long apprenticeship. Another is that Turnbull's history is full of close associations with the Labour Party. A close lifelong friendship with Neville Rann, for example, past associations and friendships with Bob Carr and the Western Australian former Premier Peter Dowding. When Turnbull was a university student in the 70s, he didn't march in pro-Kerr, anti-Whitlam rallies like Tony Abbott or Peter Costello. He was up visiting the ancient and bile-filled former Labour Premier Jack Lang, then in his 90s, with a view to writing a musical about Jack Lang's life, along with Turnbull's good friend Bob Ellis. Much of the musical, most unfortunately, is lost to history, although I do preserve a fragment of it in the essay. But you can understand why the more staid denizens of the Liberal jungle have their reservations. But Turnbull himself is not one to spend much time on the reservations of others. If there's anything at all to be drawn from his past life in business and law, it's that Malcolm Turnbull backs himself very strongly in most situations. He views life as a meritocracy and himself as, happily, full of merit. His success in business was based on a good brain, utter fearlessness, and the preparedness to take risks. He has, in addition, a tiny, sparkling silver thread of luck running through his life, on which he has relied with great success from time to time. Some of these characteristics transfer well to politics. I think in the past few weeks we've seen a rather graphic demonstration of what can happen when the luck runs out. Now, opposition is a dark time for any party. Just ask anyone in the Australian Labor Party who was around just 5 years ago, when the way ahead was dim indeed, and lit only sporadically by another bit of Mark Latham catching fire. Opposition is no fun at all, but one of its few recommendations is that it does provide an opportunity for regeneration in public debate, which is unavailable to parties in government. Unfortunately, most oppositions tend to be too depressed and traumatised to realise this straight away. Like all the recently bereaved, they need to go through the formal stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Which pretty much sums up where Tony Abbott's been for the last 18 months. Governments spend their time trying to cut off opportunities for oppositions. Of course they do. But opposition is full of opportunities, nonetheless. I think that the second Costello announcement, made on the 15th of June, was a seismic day for the Liberal Party because it was an opportunity, a moment at which Malcolm Turnbull finally had the liberty to pursue the leadership of the Liberal Party free of the oppression of his nebulous rival. It was only a couple of days, however, before the horror of the Godwin-Gretsch email came crashing in, providing a whole new series of problems. But look, I think there are two opportunities for the coalition created by the Rudd government as it's presently composed. One of them is an economic management argument created by the Rudd government's decision to commit Australia to extensive public debt and to err on the side of excess in its liberal application of stimulus to the economy. This is a prime argument for the coalition. It deals with an area of traditional strength for the coalition and weakness for the Labor Party. And unlike some of the other major issues before the Australian Parliament today, like climate change or the regulation of industrial relations, the coalition is actually capable of reaching an agreement on this subject without having to kill Wilson Tuckey. And Malcolm Turnbull and Joe Hockey are already, as you will undoubtedly have noticed, making much of this opportunity. Now, the second opportunity, and this is where I'll end, is more oblique, but full of potential nonetheless, in my opinion. The story of the Rudd government so far is a fascinating one, remarkable in many ways for what hasn't gone wrong. It's a fascinating counterpoint to the first short term of the Howard government, a very lively period during which almost everything went wrong. Kevin Rudd has demonstrated himself to be a master of politics, an impresario who is expert at appealing to the audience in front of which he finds himself at any given time. To a domestic audience, he serves up snags with a fairly shaken sauce bottle, whereas for sophisticated foreign audiences, he offers detailed programmatic specificities. Now, all this is working for him, it seems, but I wonder if it will forever. And Mr. Rudd's disciples in the Parliamentary Labour Party, who are as surprised as anyone that their resident nerd has overnight become the most popular Australian Prime Minister in recent memory, tend nevertheless to fall in with his style, relentlessly on message, tightly controlled. Question Time has become a series of statements read word for word, carefully prepared in advance. Ministers have become experts at mastering the message. Their television interviews generally are long and successful experiments in question avoidance. And in this atmosphere, I think there's a small but appreciable market for authenticity in politics, and it's growing every day. I think the times will suit, for example, people like Tony Abbott, who are geared towards candour in their public pronouncements, and in Abbott's case it's something of a compulsion. Turnbull too is in a position to capitalise on his natural tendency to disclose his views. In summary, I think there's much work to be done in the Liberal Party, as there always is for parties in the first term of opposition. The creatures who ran the show for years are not long gone, and the creatures of the future are still creating themselves. It's a long road, but not necessarily a dispiriting one. And that's enough from me, but I think there might be some.
Many thanks, Annabelle Crabb. Annabelle's book, booklet, essay, Court Essay, Stop at Nothing, Janet Grundy's got copies of it, and I'm sure Annabelle would be happy to sign any after the event. So we come to question and discussion, and we'll finish not later than 7 o'clock, and I should say many thanks to Clayton Utz for the use of this great facility this evening. Just to go back on the theme of the earlier part of your talk, which I think is in the latter part of your of your essay, leaving aside Downer and Howard, who were long liberals going back to their teenage years and very committed liberals, if you look at the other recent leadership aspirants, not only have they not spent much time in the Liberal Party, but also they were very politically inexperienced. And you've mentioned Brendan Nelson and Malcolm Turnbull, but the biggest disaster of all that lot, of course, was John Hewson. So why do you pick up the sort of sense that in the Liberal Party room the Liberals will give leadership to people, and Malcolm Turnbull may be the best leader at the moment, but why they tend to give leadership to people who don't have much experience? What do you think the reason for that is?
Thanks, Jared. Well, look, I think that expediency was probably the principal reason for the decision in late 2007 going the way that it did. I think that there were three people who put up their hand for the Liberal leadership after Howard lost his seat in the election and Peter Costello made the announcement that he did. They were Malcolm Turnbull and Brendan Nelson and Tony Abbott. Now, I think that Mr. Abbott had some thinking to do after the loss of the Howard government. I also think that he was so closely allied with the memory of John Howard that he would have been an inappropriate candidate at that time. and he was the most experienced in the Liberal Party, I guess. So I don't think there's any particular endemic reason why the Liberal Party made the choices that it did in late 2007. I think it was generally dazed, confused, and unable to believe the circumstances that it confronted, in truth. I think that's the answer.
I'm a bit confused myself in the question I'm asking, but remembering Menzies and his great, you know, recovery from dreadfulness of defeat, it seemed to me when he made his speech, was his recovery speech, he really appealed to a whole lot of the middle class. He didn't keep on seeing the limbs, you know, the wealthy guys up there.
Mm.
He got a class base.
Mm.
But at the moment, when I look at my friends, all of whom happen to be middle class, I've got two groups. All academics and teachers and God knows what, who are passionately anti-Howard, passionately Labour. And my other group of friends were about sensible women who all confirmed Liberal voters. how you get a Liberal base,
yeah,
which is somehow middle class, when the middle class seems to be going in two directions.
Yeah. Well, look, I think one of the secrets of the success of the Howard government in early times, and certainly the reason for the election victory in 1996, was, I mean, I think that the slogan that John Howard and his colleagues used in the 1996 election, "For all of us," is one of the masterstroke campaign slogans of all time. It kind of... you know, all prime ministers are, to some extent, a product of the person they went before, their predecessor, and I think that John Howard was created as a politician by Paul Keating in the 93 to 96 term of the Keating government. I think that John Howard capitalised on a mood that was there. He picked up voters that the Labour Party had shucked off through inattention and through ill discipline within their own ranks. So in a way, electoral politics in Australia is a bit like surfing. You know, you've got to the wave's got to be there, and then you've got to ride it properly. And I think that the old adage that governments lose elections and oppositions don't win them is substantially true. And particularly in Australia, we have a very pronounced sort of electoral cycle. Yeah.
Annabel, you mentioned that Tony Abbott's time may yet come.
Yeah.
It's interesting, there was a piece in one of the newspapers the other day about how religion and politics seem to have come back into line. Kevin Rudd makes great play of going to church, as does, you know, there was also an article recently about how they're trying to find a church for Barack Obama to go to, because he's so popular with going to church, the real believers can't get in. But the way he says Malcolm Turnbull's Achilles heel, his Wentworth electorate. And while he himself is quite religious, in the sense that he's become a Catholic, Catholic wife, but he lives in one of those electorates where it doesn't pay to be too suburban middle class. And how much is this
Achilles
heel? Well, you don't... Wentworth electorate.
Yes, I mean, I think...
what the nation is looking for.
As Howard put it in his interview with me for the essay, he said that Turnbull has an atypical electorate. I think that's certainly true. I think that he's well-suited to the electorate. I think that a lot of his public work has been about appealing to that electorate, and that brings him into conflict, I think, with quite a large swathe of the Liberal Party on some occasions. You're right, I think that he doesn't talk about his religion very much. It's almost comical to me sometimes the similarities between Turnbull and Rudd and how much each of those men would hate to hear me say that. But... Rudd kind of left the Catholic Church to become an Anglican, and Turnbull converted to Catholicism. Both, they say, on the strength of their wives' faiths. I think it's true that Kevin Rudd has allowed religion gone with the flow of the reintroduction of the Christian faith into politics in Australia. One of the examples that people often give when observing that is that you see Kevin Rudd bobbing up every Sunday doing his little doorstop outside church. Now, in his defence, I think that that's not entirely his doing. It's kind of our doing as well. I mean, the Rudds live in Canberra, and Kevin Rudd unlike John Howard, doesn't walk in the morning. So the only way where you can really grab him without prior arrangement is as he leaves the house of God. So one of the unwitting payoffs of the stalker behaviour of me and my colleagues in the Canberra Press Gallery is that he looks more and more devout every week. Now, if his weekly excursion was to Pizza Hut, then he'd look like a junk food addict, I suspect. So, while I do think he's made a very conscious attempt to reclaim religion for the Labour Party, and he's done that through his pronouncement of his fondness for Dietrich Bonhoeffer, for instance, and his extensive holiday writings. So there's a number of aspects to that part of Kevin Rudd. She probably is, I think, but... Well, I think that most prime ministers and leaders have their preferred ways of communing with people, and John Howard's an excellent example of that. He was suspicious, I think, of the press gallery, probably rightly so, and chose as his favourite medium talkback radio. He liked to be able to commune with his people uninterrupted by editors or journalists or anybody else filtering the message. Kevin Rudd's chosen, not his favourite medium. I mean, he likes to address people through the medium of weighty magazines, but he also likes going on FM radio and appearing on Rove Live, which he did recently, of course, and he's become quite interested of late in the Twitter phenomenon. In fact, he's quite a committed Twitterer and has picked up, Twitterese with which he communicates with his younger followers. And I noticed that after the Rove appearance, an appearance which he made in preference to travelling to Western Australia to appear at the Western Australian Labor Conference, and really, who could blame him? He went into that Rove interview, incidentally, with 60,000 followers on Twitter. And about 2 weeks later, I checked again, and he had 145,000 followers. So, and Rove McManus himself has about 60,000. So, I mean, he's kind of... there's a debate about how useful these social networking sites are, but politicians, I suppose, generally feel that any way of communicating with people who otherwise wouldn't be engaged in politics is a useful thing. And really... So, some of the messages of adulation that are posted on Twitter lead one to believe that at least there's some at least temporary benefit for the Prime Minister here. There seems to be a general view among some of the younger Twitterers that that Kevin Rudd is totally cool, which is certainly not necessarily borne out by the experience of the mainstream media.
Of all the pre-selections that you mentioned, one that you mentioned in the article but didn't dwell on is the pre-selection for Wentworth, Malcolm Turnbull one, which wasn't a contest of baseball bats. It was a fierce gladiatorial struggle where anything that resembled a weapon was pressed into play.
Yeah.
What more can you tell us about that pre-selection that gives us an understanding of Turnbull?
Well, the story of the pre-selection is very much like any story that you can draw out from Malcolm Turnbull's business life. He decided what he wanted. He ignored all the orthodoxies that militated against going for that particular outcome, and he stormed through, wading through blood up to his neck at various points. He was looking like he would be defeated at a number of points, but he was indefatigable in his pursuit of that goal. He spent money, he spent time, he used the legal system to mount tireless legal challenges to new memberships signed up by his opponent Peter King. It was an incredible display of what Malcolm Turnbull is capable of in business and in law. This extraordinary combination that he has of fearlessness, determination, preparedness to spend money, and inability to give in. And what it did for him within the Liberal Party, I think, was turned him into something of an ogre. You know, when he appeared, you know, drenched in blood in the party room finally after the 2004 election campaign, it was kind of like having Hannibal Lecter, you know, wheeled in, you know, who will he kill next? So I think that, you know, interestingly enough, in that first term, that short period of time, which Malcolm Turnbull spent on the back bench, I think he spent time learning quite a bit about politics, learning, for instance, that even the people in the party room that you think are dummies have a vote. It's tough for some of them to come to terms with. And he got to know some of his colleagues, and I think that he worked on being a more collegiate sort of person. And there are many criticisms that can be made of Malcolm Turnbull in the leadership of the Liberal Party at the moment. One thing that I noticed that he is very, very careful to do is to consult widely. It's almost as though he has a kind of piece of paper in front of him, a post-it note in his head saying, consult, don't be bossy. I mean, he is bossy despite himself anyway, but I mean, he always makes, he doesn't want to expose himself to the allegation that he's imposing his will on others all the time. So, you know, I think that's an example of him learning about politics and turning around some of the perceptions that grew from that extremely bloodthirsty and ultimately successful pursuit at the seat of Wentworth.
Quite interested is Malcolm Turnbull's phenomenon. There's a couple of pretty high up in the airfield who mentioned to me, and he has a very high regard for Peter Costello, but he reckoned the government was very low. This is his comment. I just like the comment. The other thing was the teacher of his at Sydney Grammar said to me that Malcolm Turnbull was looked down on by the eastern suburbs that because he didn't have money. He wasn't sort of accepted as an eastern, though the Labour Party made some that he's come with that.
He doesn't have much money currently, or?
No.
We can't take too many. We've got APEC here, so I just repeated this. The suggestion is that an allegation that he doesn't really know much about politics, and an allegation that in Wentworth he was sort of in trade, he wasn't quite well off enough. So
As a boy, he was in trade,
yes. He wasn't quite blue blood enough.
Well, as to the first point, I think the observation was that he wasn't very familiar with the mechanics of government, with the bureaucracy and so on, and I think that's certainly true. I think that he at times is puzzled that the public service doesn't work like a company, you know, and I think that dogged him a bit during his period as a minister. In some ways, that's Kevin Rudd's advantage over him. I mean, one of the interesting differences between those two leaders is that Kevin Rudd is also a highly ambitious, at times quite ruthless person who is very clever and prefers his own counsel to that of others, just like Malcolm Turnbull. But he came up and was a self-made man through the public sector, whereas Malcolm Turnbull built himself in the private sector. I think that a strategic advantage that Rudd has is that he does understand the bureaucracy better than Malcolm Turnbull does. As for the attitude to Malcolm Turnbull in Sydney Grammar, it's quite possible that there was sort of snobbishness towards him. I mean, that may contribute to his drive to succeed. I think that people who lose a parent in early life often are quite persistent people. They are certainly overrepresented in the field of politics. He didn't spend very long, I think, at Sydney Grammar or at Sydney University or anywhere in the eastern suburbs being not famous or looked down upon. He certainly corrected that fairly quickly, and he also corrected the lack of liquid funds situation pretty smartly as well.
In the course of your research for the essay, did you find much evidence of Malcolm Turnbull's father-in-law being influential in his worldview or political view?
Yes.
My background is father-in-law, right? Turnbull's father-in-law is background, who we're talking about. I'm talking about Tom.
Yes, Tom Hughes.
The question is about
Was Tom Hughes influential in Malcolm Turnbull's ascension through the Liberal Party?
Yes, I think that Tom Hughes, who is, you know, an influential and an established figure within the Liberal Party, certainly assisted to cleanse Turnbull of his associations with the Labour Party. I think that whatever Turnbull says, I think that there probably that there certainly was a bit of prevarication, a bit of confusion about which side of politics he'd eventually go with. I mean, that's not unusual for people to have those questions early in their careers, but I think certainly his marriage to Lucy Turnbull pretty much sealed the deal about which direction he'd go in. I think that Lucy Turnbull is by far, however, the most influential person to Malcolm Turnbull politically and professionally in his career before politics. They are an extremely codependent couple, I think. And one of the interesting things about Turnbull is that he almost always mentions Lucy Turnbull, his wife, in any speeches about his achievements and his career in business. She, I realised through my research, was a part strategically in almost every major achievement in his life, and even in the shadow cabinet room he's very notorious for bringing Lucy Turnbull's opinions into almost every debate. Lucy thinks this, Lucy thinks that. I mean, there are plenty of people, I think, in the shadow cabinet room who think Lucy is more sensible than Malcolm on some things, so perhaps they should just bring her in, I don't know.
Down the back, the second last question down there. Yeah. How well suited do you think Malcolm
That's an excellent question, because I think that Turnbull's thoughts more generally are how to get himself out of this position and to get himself into a winning position. That's what he's good at, and for most of his life he's been extremely self-reliant, and he's made decisions and made acquisitions and judgments that are about the welfare of himself and his family. I think that what the Liberal Party needs is a kind of, I suppose, a balance of historical figures and upcoming figures to make the decisions about where the Liberal Party goes policy-wise. I think that there is a bit of a confusion at the moment about whether adherence to the past necessarily means a betrayal of the future. I don't think that it does necessarily, but when you've had an election loss like the 2007 one, particularly after a period of great and stubborn adherence to a certain coda, you can get confused about that sort of thing. I think that Malcolm Turnbull's best opportunity is to outsource some of that so that he doesn't stand accused of dominating the process excessively.
Just a final question. Just tell us a bit about doing this. You obviously have access to Malcolm Turnbull. You certainly had one lengthy car trip. Yeah. How much access did you get, and how did you find doing a profile of him?
Complicated. I found it complicated. He's a fascinating person. He's excellent company. He was very kind to me and cooperative in the researching of this essay. Our agreement at the beginning was that we would have speak regularly off the record, and we did, and that I would have a lengthy on-the-record interview, and again, he honoured that undertaking. I followed him to Tasmania one week and leapt in a car and drove from engagement to engagement and watched him perform at a series of functions. I thought that he was very frank. In his view, probably he was too frank on a number of occasions, and as a journalist, one can only applaud that in a politician. I think that he is by nature a discloser, and I think that the interview that he gave me for the essay demonstrates that. And I think that's a quality to be admired in a politician, and I think that it's to be encouraged as well. Too often, I think in the media we give politicians every reason for being evasive rather than frank. So yes, it was complicated because he's a complicated character, and it was complicated because his life before politics is so interesting, and his personality is so interesting that I was often drawn towards a study of the man and his personality, whilst always trying to keep in mind that this was also an examination of the Liberal Party. I think that that is one of the difficulties that he faces, and one of the great, as I said, distinctions that can be drawn between him and John Howard. The fortunes of the Turnbull-led Liberal Party are always going to be a struggle between, you know, whether we're talking about the fortunes of the man or the fortunes of the group, and it's not until those two things coalesce comfortably, I think, that that they face a chance of success.
Many thanks.
Well, I'll be very brief. There are a lot of people here, as Annabelle will be happy to sign copies of Stop at Nothing. When I read the essay, I thought it was very perceptive. I have every reason to reinforce that view tonight. We've had a very informative night, but also a very entertaining night, as you would expect from this crowd. So many thanks, Annabelle, and no doubt we'll see you back in the future. Tonight, well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.